So one time when Leslie and I were studying in Greece, it was our first Sunday there, and we were, at the Glyphada Church of Christ, and they tried to get some Harding students to participate, and they asked me if I would help pass out the, elements and ultimately pray for the offering. So I do. I stand up there in front of everybody with a couple of other dudes, and they had this tradition of they would pass out the bread and then the cup, and everybody would hold it until the very end, and they would all take it together, and then you'd go on to the next thing. So we passed out the bread, and then we're standing up there all holding the bread, and then we all take it, and then we pass out the cup, and we're standing up there, and as soon as we passed out, everybody's got it, we're standing up there, and we take it, and all of a sudden, my throat started burning. And it dawned on me that this was the more fermented kind of the fruit of the vine. And then I start thinking, wait a second. Does Harding count this? And I immediately had to start praying for the offering. So there was nobody that day more surprised in doing communion than me on the face of this earth. And my prayer sounded something like this. Dear God, please help this money go to the poor. And please help those private Christian universities have a more tolerant view on their very strict no alcohol policy. Because I'm thinking, am I going to get kicked out for communion? So we're in a series called You Are What You Eat, and we're talking about this thing that people in our fellowship do every week. Christians all over the world do this, but in Churches of Christ, we have emphasized this, and it's really one of our strengths because we believe this is the most important thing we do around here every week. Every week, the sermon, we could miss the sermon. Every week, the singing might not be good, but every week, we're centered around Jesus because every week we're doing this. And this is where we receive the body and blood of Christ. And you are what you eat. Now, I want to remind you next week, John Mark Hicks, who has written the best book I have read on communion by anybody, he's going to be here. He's going to be preaching. He's going to be doing a combined adult Bible class just talking about communion. He's also going to be here on Saturday from 9 to 12 in the morning, and he's going to be doing a couple of different classes that I think will be very, very helpful. He's a very engaging presenter. He's going to be talking about assembly and how we read the Bible, and I would highly encourage all of y'all, if you have to make an opening in your life so you can be a part of it, because I promise you this will be worth your time. So we're talking about communion. Because every week we gather together and something happens. And I don't know that we're always aware of it. I don't know that we know what we're doing when we gather together and take communion. So last week we talked about how if you were just to sit down and read the Bible for the first time, one of the things that would be obvious to you, it would be surprising, is that sin, evil, entered the world not through a sexual sin, not through violence, but through food. Because God makes the whole world, and he sees that it's good. God makes this good world, and he didn't have to make it this way. God did not have to make Yarnell's Rocky Road ice cream taste so stinking good. But he did, because God likes pleasure. God enjoys us taking pleasure in this good world. The problem is whenever we put the blessings of God over God. So God gives Adam and Eve this buffet, basically, the garden. And he says, you can eat anything you want from that except this one thing. He restricts this one tree. And basically, the tree is God's way of asking, can you trust me? This whole world is yours. It's wide open to subdue and have dominion over except for this. But Adam and Eve, the answer to the question, can you trust me, sadly comes back. No. Because they can't. And they eat from the one tree God restricts. And this is how the story goes in Genesis chapter 3. If you could put that up. Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? The woman said to the serpent, we may eat from the fruit from the trees in the garden, But God did say, and then she goes on to say, and we talked about this last week, she goes on to say something God actually did not say. She adds a rule thinking she's going to help God out, but she actually winds up opening herself up to the most toxic idea of all, that God is somehow against them. God did say you can eat fruit from the tree that's in the middle of the garden, but you must not touch it. That's the rule. God didn't say that. You must not touch it, or you will die. And the serpent says, you will not die. You will certainly not die, the serpent said to the woman. For God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. And she gave some to her husband, who was also with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized that they were naked. So she focuses on the fruit, says that she, King James, she beheld it. And she made it the center of her attention. She focused on it. She wanted it. That, by the way, that's how temptation works, isn't it? And then she takes it and eats it, and her eyes were opened. Now, in the Hebrew mindset, there are two different ways of seeing. The kind of seeing that comes with obedience and the kind of seeing that comes without it. And so it says that their eyes were opened, but in a very real sense, the Jewish people would have understood here is where their eyes were closed. And there's a reason that we have told this story for thousands of years, because every single one of us can relate to what it's like. We've all had a kind of Garden of Eden experience in our life. The preacher Carlisle Money was once asked where the Garden of Eden was, and he said, it's on 215 West Elm Street, because that's where I stole money from my mother for the first time. I remember when I was 14, going to church with mom and dad. For me, the Garden of Eden is in the Huckabee's gas station, because that's where I stole Mentos and put them in my pocket on my way to church. And as we were driving along, something had changed inside of me. I was the same, but everything was different. There's not a person in this room who can't relate to this. My eyes had been opened. That's what you're seeing in the Garden of Eden. God has these dreams for his people, and they just fell. But more to the point, we just fell. Now, Adam and Eve, they leave the garden. They're banished from the garden. They wind up having a couple of kids. And then one of those kids rises up and kills the other, making them the world's first dysfunctional family. And God responds by sending the murderer, the Cain. He sends him away from everyone. And the word that the Bible uses for exile, uses for that is exile. Look at what it actually says in Genesis chapter 4. So after Cain kills his brother, Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Eden is where everything is as God intends. But Genesis wants you to know, Cain doesn't live in Eden. He lives east of there. The first few chapters of Genesis, if you're reading it, you start noticing everybody's moving east. See, God had this dream for his people. But we're headed a different direction. History is headed a different direction, away from God's plan. They're headed east. That's what you find in the Bible over and over again. People are headed in the wrong direction, which is not a hard thing for anyone in this room to understand. Because some of you, your life has been on autopilot. And maybe in the last couple of weeks, you woke up and you realized you have found yourself headed in a direction you never wanted to be. Some of you, it's your marriage. Your marriage is in trouble. You've made some questionable personal decisions. Or some of us, what started out as a fun pastime has now started to become an addiction. This is the human condition. We drift away from the direction God has for us. And that brings us to the Gospel of Luke for one final time. Because for the past 14 months, we have been going through the Gospel of Luke, the story of Jesus. Because what I wanted you to see is what the early church did is what Jesus did. The early church, the first Christians, were trying to be like Jesus in the world. And Luke wants you to know that Jesus spent a lot of time at tables. I told you last week, 20% of the gospel of Luke is Jesus coming from a meal, going to a meal, or eating at a meal. The gospel of Luke wants you to know Jesus loves to eat. If you can read that book without getting hungry, you're reading it wrong. But the gospel of Luke doesn't just want you to know that Jesus is at a table a lot. They want you to know the kind of things he was doing at the table, the kind of people that he was with at the table. Luke is trying to show us in the book of Acts, which is the sequel to the Gospel of Luke. Luke is trying to show us that the early Christians, whenever it says they broke bread, it's the same language used in the Gospel of Luke for Jesus having a meal. It's trying to show you this is the table of Jesus. This is what Jesus did. So when we have communion every week, it is not some dry ritual that we're just checking off. You're at the table of Jesus Christ. And that's why Luke connects all these meals that Jesus had in the Gospel of Luke to what the church is doing in the book of Acts. When you take communion, you're remembering the table of Jesus and who he ate with. It is the table of Jesus. It's not your table. It's not my table. Jesus had communion with saints and sinners, the rich and poor, educated and uneducated. It is a table for you. It is a table for me, but it is never my table. It is never your table. It belongs to Jesus, so it is a table for everyone, no matter where you're at in life, no matter what you're going through in life, and it is a table of hope. So turn with me for one last time to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 24. There is a couple of disciples. Jesus has been crucified. It looks like all hope is lost. They're walking outside of Jerusalem, and as far as they're concerned, not only has Jesus died, but their hope has died as well. In chapter 24, starting in verse 13, "Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked," by the way, when it says on that same day, it's talking about the Sunday after Jesus was crucified. 3 days after Jesus was crucified. And notice what they're doing. They're walking away from Jerusalem. They're walking away from the city of God. They're walking in a different direction. And why? Because they've given up. They'd given up on Jesus. They'd given up on this whole dream. They're incredibly heartbroken. And they don't know God has raised Jesus from the dead just hours earlier. And then Jesus shows up. And they don't recognize him. And it is such a bummer when you raise from the dead and your friends don't recognize you. Starting in verse 15. Here's what happens. "As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked among them. But they were kept from recognizing him. And he asked, 'What are you discussing together as you walk along?' They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, 'Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?' 'What things?' Jesus asked." He's playing coy with them. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was going to be the one who redeemed Israel. What is more, it's the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but they didn't find his body. They came and told us they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see Jesus." Did you catch those four words? Right in the middle of them trying to explain what's going on, they say, "But we had hoped he was going to be the one." That is some of the hardest words in the English language. We had hoped this marriage would last. We had hoped we would get a better report from the doctor. We had hoped we wouldn't have to ever check our kid into rehab again. Not much is harder than hope in the past tense. Jesus, to be fair to them, ended up where they never thought he would. They thought he was the Messiah. They thought he was God's chosen one. They never thought he would end up on a cross and on a tomb. They never thought that the person who they had seen do so many miracles, who obviously had some kind of power from God, would have that happen to him. They thought that once God's Messiah came, if he really was God's Messiah, he would not just be able to do miracles, he would overthrow Rome, their greatest enemy. Instead, he dies at the hands of Rome, and get this, their own Jewish religious leaders helped. They didn't see that coming. Nobody saw that coming. It was not in the job description for the Messiah. In fact, because it happened to him, you can see them kind of processing. That's what they're talking about as they walk away from Jerusalem. It made them reconsider all their hopes and dreams. Because when Jesus died, their hope died with him. Because of the way they viewed him and what they expected him to do. And the reason this is so important to get is because I don't know where you're at in life. But every one of us at one point in our life is going to be walking on this road. The road when all hope looks lost. And it's worth noting that those two disciples, a lot of people think it's a husband and wife, like a couple. That those two disciples weren't looking for Jesus. They didn't know to. They were hopeless. But Jesus, like always, was looking for them. And Jesus starts a Bible study like you do. So in chapter 24, starting in verse 25, here's what happens. He said to them, this is a little too aggressive, Jesus. He says to this heartbroken, hopeless couple, kind of dumb, aren't you? He says, how foolish you are. How slow to believe all the things the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter into his glory? And the answer to that question would have been, no. Nobody thought that. And then, and check this out, this is why, if you're a Christian and you have not paid attention to the Old Testament, you need to get in this Old Testament. This, I would love to have heard this Bible study. In verse 27, and beginning with Moses and the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Wouldn't you have liked to have heard that? Sometimes Christians talk about, like, God converted to Christianity in Jesus. No, God has always been the same God. And these stories that run throughout from Genesis to Malachi are dripping with Jesus. The early Christians, you know what their Bible was? The first church, you know what its Bible was? It was what we today call the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures. And they saw Jesus everywhere. You know why? Because Jesus gave them eyes to see. That's what he's doing. He opens the Bible and from Genesis on preaches, do you not see this is who God has always been? But first he calls them dumb. He says, you're so foolish and you haven't been insulted until you've been insulted by the risen Lord, right? But why does he call them foolish? It's not like anybody else saw this coming. On Easter morning, nobody was lined up outside the tomb going 3, 2, 1. Nobody saw this coming. I mean, why is he so blunt and direct with them here? It's because this isn't the first time Jesus has tried to tell his followers what was coming. He said repeatedly, look, I'm going to die. God is going to do something that is unexpected. I'm going to die, and God's going to use it. But his disciples weren't listening. I don't know about you, but for me, it's sometimes the unexpected stuff in life that kind of opens me up for God to do his good work in them, in me. And isn't it interesting that Jesus, to this downtrodden, heartbroken couple, doesn't do a miracle. He can do those. He does a Bible study. He takes them through the scripture and helps them see the plan and story of God. They thought his death was the end of the world. They thought it meant failure and despair. But that's because they didn't realize God was up to more than just Israel and more than just getting rid of their current problems. And maybe this is a word you need to hear today. They thought that their problems were Roman taxation. They thought that their problems were, they were, you know, shamed nationally. But Jesus knows something that we often forget. There are worse things than Caesar and bigger problems than Rome. There are powers of darkness. There sin and death and regret and shame and even Satan himself. And sometimes it is those moments where we hit rock bottom. It is those moments where we find ourselves on the road walking away without hope. When God's doing the most work. It's those moments that might just make the biggest difference in our life. But, and this is important, it is not the Bible study that changes them. It is the meal. Because look at what happens next. In verse 28. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he were going further. But they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening and the day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. And when he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" And then they got up at once and returned to Jerusalem. They found the 11 gathered together. Do you see what's happening here? The first time that food is mentioned in the Bible, Adam and Eve eat it, and their eyes are open. And they start heading a different direction than God's intent. They start going away from God. And in the Road to Emmaus story, they eat bread with the risen Lord, and their eyes are open, and then they turn a different trajectory. Do you see what's happening every week when we take communion? God is reversing the fall. When you gather around the table of Jesus, God is reversing the original sin. Preachers, notice this story. Preachers sometimes talk about Jesus' resurrection. The disciples, they come to understand that Jesus was raised from the dead in some mysterious way. He warmed their heart, or they realized he was alive in some special sense. No, that's not how this happened at all. They get dragged kicking and screaming into the realization that Jesus is still alive no matter what Rome tried to do to him. They didn't slowly just, you know what, the crucifixion wasn't that bad. They had been given an announcement, Jesus is risen. Death cannot hold them. Now, what are you going to do about it? And the reason this is so big is because when you gather together to receive communion, you don't just need self-improvement. You don't just need a little bit of self-help. You need a new story. We need a new direction. And that's what Jesus is giving us every week. You get to be a part of this giant story. This story isn't a part of your life. Church, Jesus, God, faith isn't just a segment of your life. It is the center of your life. This table, when we receive communion, changes every other table. It changes how you eat, how you think of your life, who you eat with. Jesus, sometimes you hear preachers say, you need to invite Jesus into your life. No! Your life's a dumpster fire. Jesus is inviting you into his life. It's at this table every week we remember there is more grace in God than there is sin in people. It's at this table every week we remember the price he paid is greater than the mess we've made. That God's life is abundantly available to us. You know the reason that the angels rolled the tombs, why they rolled the stone away? Because Jesus could walk through walls. Why did they do that? It wasn't to let Jesus out, it was to let us in. And when we gather together at this table every week, we're reminded we are with the risen Lord and all the ways our eyes have been closed. The scales fall off just like they did for Paul. And we can see again what's true and what's not. So a few years ago, I went with Everett Hufford, who's a professor at Harding School of Theology. I went with Everett Hufford and 50 people from the Southeast to the Holy Lands. I was doing a series for the church I worked at, Highland, and I wanted to take video and show them places where Jesus was for this series. And I got to know all these people. It was a really fun trip. The median age was 65, and that was with me and four other 30-year-olds. And one of my favorite people on this trip was Miss Shirley. She was a 70-something-year-old African-American lady from Memphis. And I loved seeing the Holy Lands with Miss Shirley. Just walking along and getting to know each other. At one point, she told me that when Dr. King came to Memphis, she got to march with those civil rights movement workers. And in order to do that, she, even though she was just 14 years old, she had to be trained on nonviolent resistance. How to, like, not get angry when somebody did things like spit on you. How not to fight back. And then she said the most difficult part of that training was when they tried to get them prepared for what would happen if police released dogs. I asked Miss Shirley, "Were you ever scared?" And she said, "No." And then she came back a few minutes later and said, "Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I was scared when it came to the dogs." And I asked Miss Shirley after spending a couple of weeks with her, "Miss Shirley, why are you not angry? You seem to carry that really lightly." And I will never forget what she said. Shirley goes, "Jonathan, it's because there is a promised land." And then I realized she wasn't just there so she could see the promised land. She was there because her whole future, her whole life had been oriented around this. That the future doesn't have to be like the past. You know what? Every week when we gather together for communion, you know what we're remembering as we receive this? There is such a thing as a perfect justice, and one day it will roll down like the river. There is such a thing like perfect righteousness, and one day it will flow like a never-ending stream. If we want mercy, we got to remember there is such a thing as a good and compassionate God. There is a promised land, and it continues to change everything. So tomorrow, we celebrate the life of Dr. King. It's a federal holiday, and we must never forget that during his life, Dr. King was considered by the federal government one of the most dangerous people in America. We celebrate the life of Dr. King tomorrow, but on the day before he died, Dr. King stood up and preached a sermon, and he said, "I don't know what's going to happen now. We've got hard times ahead. I don't know what's going to happen to me, but it doesn't matter. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's let me climb the mountain, and I have seen there is a promised land. So I'm happy tonight because I can see it from here." Do you know the best metaphor for the communion that I know of in the Bible? It's when the promised land, when God is trying to get the Israelites to go in it, and they send the 12 spies, and they go to the Canaan, and they see all, you know, how big the food is, and they bring back fruit from the promised land. It's like grapes the size of your head. And everybody eats it, even though they're not in the promised land yet. That's what you're doing every week when we receive communion. That's what happens. Every week we're remembered that no matter how difficult your life is, no matter how difficult the season is, Jesus is saying, "Hey, put a comma there, not a period." Because of Jesus, because of this table, the worst things in life are never period. The worst things in life are never the last things. There's no sense in living like it's a period. At this table, every week, we remember to the elderly person whose health is almost gone, whose life, you don't have to live in fear anymore. You have a resurrection coming. You're taking the fruit of the promised land. To the devastated wife whose husband has left you and you feel betrayed and alone, you don't have to. You have a resurrection coming. To the frightened parents of a depressed child, you don't have to live burdened by the weight of blame. You have a resurrection coming. To the anxious worker who's lost their job, you don't have to live in anxiety. You have a resurrection coming. To a guilt-ridden addict and you're hiding in the shadows and you come to church pretending like everything's fine, but you know it's not. You don't have to live this way. The table says you have a resurrection coming. To the lonely single young person who's longing to be loved, you don't have to live that way. You have a resurrection coming. The meal that Jesus has in the Gospel of Luke in this story is the eighth meal he has. In Jewish numerology. 8 is the number of new beginnings. Luke ends his gospel with people finding a new beginning where they thought there was an end. That's what we do when we're gathered together for communion. We give thanks and praise for the one who gave up his life so that we can have a new beginning. Because Jesus is alive, so our hope is.